extremist. Pavia Street lent its name to the Gestapo prison located at one of its corners, Pavjak, a veritable house of horrors. Youssef headed up the youth association on Ogrodova Street, the midtown ghetto, just a stone's throw from the headquarters of the much-reviled Jewish police forces. And Irina also delivered smuggled supplies to her old comrade-in-arms from their days in the welfare services. Youssef had been a prominent city attorney before the German occupation started, and more than once Irina had waited with him in the halls of the courthouse, each of them leaning up against the stair railings and joking. Youssef defended people who were illegally evicted from their homes by unscrupulous landlords, and Irina was one of his favorite witnesses in the social services. She reveled in righting an injustice, and could be, Youssef told the other attorneys with a laugh, very persuasive. In between the audience with the judges, Youssef would tell her about the best nightclubs in Warsaw, just as if she were the kind of girl who might be interested. The ghetto attorneys now filled Youssef with disgust. Many members of the ghetto police were former lawyers and even judges who had taken up law enforcement with a zeal born of self-interest and financial opportunity. Elements within the Jewish police service, which reported to the Gestapo, were notoriously corrupt and brutal. Its officers patrolled the ghetto walls, conscripted residents to meet German slave labor quotas, and often lined their pockets like thugs, extracting from fellow Jewish residents crippling bribes and ransoms. So Youssef did instead what he could to check their growing power. Along with Adam and Arik, he threw his energies into the Jewish resistance movement slowly taking shape. With a small group of like-minded friends, Youssef joined an underground socialist press that circulated newspapers and pamphlets urging citizens to action both inside and outside the ghetto. Youssef's secret cell met for weekly organizational meetings in a garden tool shed on Leshno Street, out behind the old rectory at St. Mary's. The Catholic church grounds straddled the ghetto wall, and secret passageways led from one side to the other. At the end of the long garden, sitting on overturned garden pots and wistfully fingering cigarettes that could not be lit for fear of detection, the conspirators plotted distribution points and debated the finer aspects of how to carry papers undetected by the Germans. Among their company most days was a small and fearless Polish woman, a woman whom those who knew her best suspected had her finger in everything good that happened in the ghetto. It made Youssef's heart light to have his old friend Irina Sendler sitting there with them in the shadows. Chapter 5. Calling Dr. Korczak. Warsaw, January 1942. By the winter of 1941-42, the beginning of the second year in the ghetto, Irina had another, even more daring project brewing quietly. When the women in the social services offices on the Aryan side met that winter at Irina's apartment and huddled around the kitchen table, they talked in low, quiet voices while her mother dozed in the bedroom and were not quite so light-hearted as formerly. They had seen enough by now to know what would happen if they were discovered. Already there had been Gestapo purges inside the welfare offices, and one supervisor had been deported to a concentration camp in the east, called Auschwitz. Their urgent evening conversations were increasingly about safety measures. Beyond this room, they each used code names now as the network expanded. Jadwiga Deneka chose the name Kasia. Irina chose Jolanta. The risks of detection grew with every additional person they drew into the circle, and there were now more than a dozen collaborators. There in the innermost sanctum, the old friends and conspirators could at least be frank and honest, but that didn't mean there weren't tensions. The core group on the Aryan side was still the same small circle of Dr. Radlinska's girls, too, all of them sometimes smugglers now. Irina Sendler, Irka Schulz, Jadwiga Deneka, Jaga Petrovska, and her sister Janka Grabowska. Forging requisition orders and ferrying food and medicine into the ghetto were dangerous enough, but the women were making plans for a new kind of covert action, too. Action in which the stakes were even higher. The trouble was it would take more than six of them to do it. They would need to bring more people into the network. They would once again have to decide whom they could trust. They would have to decide especially about Jan Dobraczynski. On the question of Jan, there was a brewing disagreement. Jan Dobraczynski was a senior administrator in one of the offices of the Warsaw Welfare Department, and his family pedigree should have made him a key partner. His father, Valery, was one of the pioneers of the Warsaw Social Services Movement, right along with Dr. Radlinska and other professors at the Polish Free University. In fact, Jan's father had been the director of the city welfare programs until his retirement in 1932, and after 40 years on the job, Valery still knew everyone in the social services sector. His son, though, was rumored to be a different kind of character. Jan had followed in his father's footsteps, joining social services the year after his father's retirement, but his real passions were writing and religion. Jan was not part of any left-wing circles, and he certainly didn't go in for socialism. Unlike the conspirators, he wasn't an acolyte of Dr. Radlinska. Jan was a few months younger than Irena, but he acted middle-aged already, an old-fashioned sort, proud of his traditional values and a devout Catholic. What bothered Irena, though, was Jan's repulsive politics. Jan had been an active member of the far-right ultranationalist party for years, the party behind the odious Bench Ghetto. That meant Jan was also anti-Semitic. He believed in Poland for the Poles, and in his mind, Poles were, by definition, Catholic. When it came to the Jewish question, Jan liked to think he was fair-minded, but the fact was Jan didn't mind saying that anyone could see that there should be some restrictions on those people. The Jews just had too much power. They controlled some entire sections of the economy, shutting out Poles. And as far as Jan could see, it had been bound to cause conflict sooner or later. What had the Jews expected? Although Jan was secretly active in resistance movements too, because resistance alone united the left and the right in wartime Poland. His German supervisors found him cooperative and reliable. After the first office purges, Jan was promoted to director of the Adult and Child Protective Care Unit, with oversight of more than a dozen different institutions and several thousand welfare recipients. And that was the root of the dilemma. Jan was in a position, Jaga insisted, to be helpful to them. Jaga's work brought her into regular contact with Jan, and they had to think of the possibilities. Irena nodded. That was true. Jan's position was an advantage. His politics, however, told against him. Irena wasn't sure she could trust him further than they already did with their secrets. Jan knew that they were manipulating the paperwork to thwart German regulations. He even helped them cover their tracks, not because he cared about helping Jewish families, but because it was resistance. But Irena and her cell needed something more than Jan looking the other way tactfully. And the question remained, was Jan Dobraczynski seriously going to risk his own neck to help Jewish people? It was hard for Irena to resist making a little moo of distaste every time she thought of Jan Dobraczynski. But she also noticed the sudden blush that crept up Jaga's cheeks when she defended Jan from these aspersions on his character. Irena studied her friend closely. Was Jaga in love with Jan? It occurred to Irena that the chemistry was obvious. Irena, whose own family described her as an agnostic with an unruly love life, a married woman in love with a married man, took a relaxed view of these things. There was no judgment. But Jan Dobraczynski? For weeks, Irena debated silently about Jan. She didn't trust him. But she did trust Jaga, and her friend's passionate endorsement meant something. She certainly didn't want to quarrel. In January, things came to a point of crisis. The chief of the German police called Jan one morning with some typically imperious orders. The chief wanted a roundup of street children on the Aryan side of the city. The social services divisions could either get these urchins off the streets permanently, or the police would see the verminous youth exterminated. Typhus was decimating the ghetto, and it was only a matter of time before the epidemic spread farther, beyond the walled quarter. These little lice-covered beggars were likely carriers. The disease was already killing more than a few Germans. "Delouse the children and get them off my streets once and for all," those were the chief's instructions. Otherwise, the chief would see to it that the Germans handled it. Jan didn't like to think about how the Nazis handled things. Jan's job was to oversee the placement of Polish orphans and Polish street children in local institutions. His office completed intake interviews and, most important, reviewed birth certificates and baptismal records to document their family histories. Children with the correct paperwork came and went in a tidy fashion, sent onward to safe places across the city. Jewish children had no business being outside the ghetto and were not eligible for services. The frontline task of locating and caring for Warsaw's children, however, fell to social workers in the field offices, and especially to young women like Jaga Piotrowska and Jadwiga Deneka. Jan, in fact, spent a good part of his day far from the welfare offices, working surreptitiously for the Polish resistance. Officially, the Germans insisted that he work long hours. "For an absurdly low salary, you had to be stuck in the office 10 hours, he complained. But Jan quickly found a way around it. "Of course I was sitting not there for 10 hours. I tried to be in the office at the beginning and at the end of the workday. What he did in between, the Germans never seemed to notice." Jan passed the job along to the field offices, and Jaga swiftly got word back to Irena and the others. Together their team swept the city and rounded up the child beggars. Street urchins were taken in truckloads to one of the city's shelters, and the women's plan was to clean them up, get them checked over by the doctors, and send them along, with Jan's stamp of approval as orphan placement director, to one of the care homes where they maintained regular contacts as social workers. Across Warsaw, the streets were filled with hungry children. Deprivation was not confined to the ghetto. Orphans and starvation were part of the grim reality of wartime. Since the start of the occupation, the number of abandoned or orphaned youngsters they were placing in the city's care institutions had doubled. Whereas they used to send 600 youngsters a year to the Father Bauduin Children's Home, one of the charitable church institutions Jaga worked with most closely, the number was now more than 1,200. Not all those extra 600 children, though, were strictly speaking Catholic. There were, one might say, periodic irregularities, times when the paperwork might get a bit inventive. Faking the welfare files to get social benefits for poor Jewish families, the original plan of Irena and her office co-workers, was substantially harder once the Jewish families were trapped inside the ghetto, and any aid had to be smuggled across the checkpoints. Increasingly, Irena's team of conspirators was working on new ways to find the elusive documents needed to complete those false files, and to help the Jewish people who were brave enough to risk living on the Aryan side of the city create a Polish identity. That mostly meant locating blank or forged birth certificates, and there were different inventive approaches. One of the simplest methods was also the saddest. When a Christian child died in one of the orphanages, the key thing was to make sure that the death was never reported. The name and registry number were passed along instead to give a new identity and a place to a Jewish foundling. Chances to make a ghoulish swap like this required timing and patience. Now, on this winter afternoon, dozens of skinny little children's bodies filled the room, boys and girls caught up in the sweep of street beggars. In wartime, children didn't giggle or scream with laughter, especially not these children. Homeless orphans lived and died wild on the streets of Warsaw's Aryan district, too. And these were the hardy survivors. Irena moved among them with her calm and quiet voice, reassuring. She was a tiny and trim person, hardly bigger than some of the boys herself. But she was an organizational wonder. The women had a smooth system operating. One by one, the girls in the office would cut the children's hair, collect their clothes, and send them off for a good lye soap washing. The smell of the harsh soap stung painfully, and the room was bitter cold, but the children were eerily quiet. Yaga and Irena knew that they would find among these children some boys whose naked, shivering bodies betrayed their dangerous secret. Circumcision was a death sentence. Blackmailers and thugs stopped on the street any men or boys they guessed might be Jewish and ordered them to reveal their penises for inspection, often with sadistic consequences. There would naturally be a handful of Jewish children in a roundup of street waifs. The most desperate ghetto children risked their lives to cross the wall, hoping to beg or smuggle enough to feed themselves and often their families. What the women hadn't been prepared for was the fact that nearly half of the dozens of street children that day were Jewish. Yaga's stricken face told the whole story. This was a disaster. The children arrived in streams all day, one truckload after another, and when the German police arrived unannounced to supervise the baths and delousing of the first arrivals, Irena and Yaga exchanged frantic glances. Yaga gestured toward the back door and smoothed her dress to calmly greet the German arrivals. Irena swiftly nodded. Two little circumcised boys were quickly helped to disappear out through the service entrance. Yaga ran interference with soft smiles and devout protestations. "Take them to my parents' house," she whispered urgently before turning. "Are you certain?" Yaga shrugged. It was a gesture that said, "What's the other option?" The two frightened children without family left to care for them would pass the night in a house on Lekarska Street where Yaga lived with her parents, Marian and Selina, her sister Vanda, her husband Janusz, and their small daughter Hanna. It was unthinkably brazen. Yaga's house, just a stone's throw from the German war hospital and the Volksdeutsche medical housing, was on a street that swarmed night and day with sentries. But they couldn't take all these children home. Not any of them could risk that. When the trucks stopped coming that afternoon, the final tally included 32 unmistakably Jewish children. What were they going to do with them? They couldn't turn them over to the Germans. Should they tell Jan the truth? "It's come to this," Irena realized grimly. Yaga seemed so certain that Jan's heart was in the right place. Still, Irena hesitated. She knew that her friend didn't understand this suspicion. In the end, what was the alternative? They would have to find these children safe places to disappear, and that depended on Jan, as section director, helping. 32 youngsters were too many to disappear through a back entrance in an occupied city. Finding dozens of forged Kennkarte, the all-important German-issued identity cards, at a moment's notice was impossible. Saving these children would mean doing it without official documents, and that meant they would need Jan's silence and cooperation. There was no way around it. They would have to tell Jan, and they agreed that Yaga would do the talking. Jan was in torment when he understood what Yaga wanted. There was nothing he wanted more than to please Yaga. He also understood clearly enough what it would mean if the Germans came and picked up the urchins. Jan crossly thought to himself that he didn't need Irena to explain it to him. The penalty for leaving the ghetto was execution, and these children had been found on the Aryan side of the city. Yes, he knew that. But it was also summary execution for any Gentile who helped them. And this, in his opinion, was a pretty harebrained operation. Ultimately, it was up to Jan to make the final decision. He was the one to whom the police chief had given the orders. The chief would ask for a report from him. If there had just been one or two children, it might have been different, Jan told himself. That he might have risked. But this was too many. Surely the women could see that. He implored Yaga to understand. He wasn't willing to authorize 32 doomed orphanage transfers, not when the Germans were holding him responsible for this operation. He wasn't willing to ask the orphanage directors, old friends of his father and his family, to take on so many children without Aryan papers. When he made the telephone call, he told the German supervisor the truth. Yes, there were Jewish children. Dozens of them. When he set the receiver down afterward, there was every reason for his hands to be shaking. The German was a bastard. Even as Germans went, he was a bastard. He might still come and shoot them all dead in the street just for the hell of it, too. But Jan had done the best he could. In theory, they had to come to an arrangement. It had not come cheaply. Jan kept quiet about that part of things. But there were no free passes with the Germans. Jan had 24 hours. He would have to pull some strings, and he would have to call the old doctor. He already knew that Irene was going to be furious. They had to smuggle the children back into the ghetto. Jan's aging father was a friend of the old doctor, Dr. Janusz Korczak, the legendary educator and children's rights activist in Poland, who was now the director of the crowded ghetto orphanage, set up next door to Eva Rechtman's youth circle. But Eva wasn't the only one in their circle with a soft spot for the kindly doctor. All of Dr. Radlinska's girls had admired the doctor since their early days on the campus of the Polish Free University, where Dr. Korczak lectured alongside the professor. Jadwiga Deneka had trained in one of his innovative schools before the war and thought of him as her dearest mentor. Ala Golam Grinberg pulled family strings and even tolerated her cousin Viera to raise money for the doctor's children. And Irena loved both the doctor and the eager little people who crowded around her excitedly when, on her daily trips in and out of the ghetto, she smuggled across for them small presents of candy or the whimsical Jewish dolls that Dr. Witwicki made for them according to the children's elaborate orders. Dr. Korczak was no stranger to any of them. But for Irena, that would never make what happened any better. In the winter of 1941-42, entering the ghetto wasn't strictly necessary to get a message to the doctor. Telephones in and out of the ghetto still worked in a few places, an astonishing but fortuitous oversight that allowed for more than one daring rescue operation. Jan could only hope the doctor would help him. He needed some place to send the children. At my request, Jan said, my father telephoned him. If Jan could get the children back over the wall without the guards shooting them all, would the doctor agree to take the orphans? Dr. Korczak consented. The ghetto was not a place of choices either. They had just a few hours to plan the perilous operation. There was a breach in the wall that week in the Muranov district, unless the Germans had already closed it. If they had, no matter, there would be another. The ghetto orphans knew exactly where the holes were. The would-be rescuers simply had to ask the children. Irena could not believe what Jan was telling her. She cursed herself silently. She should have found another solution. He was going to send children back into the ghetto? She was in and out of that hellhole 3-4 times daily, and she would never agree to this. Only someone who had no idea what happened there would jump at such a cowardly, pathetic non-solution. There were hard, bitter recriminations. Irena confessed later that it was a terrible quarrel. Jan was reeling. She had not minced words with him in her anger. But Jan had made his deal with the German inspector. The pre-dawn hours under cover of darkness would have been a better time for this kind of stealth operation, but after curfew the patrols on the streets had shoot-to-kill orders. Jan knew that he would have to help the children crawl back through a breach in the wall that evening, as the last anxious residents rushed for home and cover before the streets went dangerously quiet. On the other side, Dr. Korchak assured Jan, someone from the orphanage would wait to meet them. Jan would go to the wall with the children himself. If he were honest with himself, his conscience was already nagging at him. He knew he could not expect any sympathy from Irena. Beside herself with disgust, she wanted nothing to do with Jan's operation. On the street, the children edged close to him. Jan listened for every noise. Footsteps now could portend disaster. In the snow, everything seemed louder, and the children's breath in the cold air sent up cloudy wisps of vapor. In his gloves, Jan could feel his fingertips growing cold and tried to rub them in his pockets. His head ached from listening, and when the code word that they had been waiting for came back in a young boy's voice, Jan caught his breath involuntarily. He understood for the first time that it was, on the other side of the wall, a children's operation. There was a little scuffle and rattle, and then a small passageway was cleared in an instant. The children did not wait for his instructions. One by one, without hesitation, the street children smiled their tired goodbyes and wriggled past him into that other world. There was the girl with the bright hair ribbon.
"Goodbye, Mr. Dobrachinsky," she whispered.
There was the small boy who stumbled for an instant in the outsized shoes someone had found for him, and the cheeky pair of brothers whom he did not doubt would be back over the wall before the week was over. He waited to hear their quiet footsteps on the other side. "A few minutes before curfew," Jan said, "I personally escorted the children to the ghetto wall. Each one went through, and thus they disappeared from the official list of young beggars. The operation succeeded. When Irena checked up on them the next day at the ghetto orphanage, the old doctor assured her that the children had made it to him safely. She should have been relieved, she knew. She tried to understand the logic of Jan's decision. But for Irena this was defeat on the deepest level. Never again would she sit by while children were returned to the ghetto. In the months to come, she would take new, bolder measures. She would smuggle more food and medicine. She would smuggle faster. She and Irka Schultz would manage to get over 1,000 doses of vaccine into the walled quarter. Other friends and co-workers in her ever-growing and ever-bolder relief network, Yaga Piotrowska included, would smuggle in another 5,000. She would carry in wads of cash rolled in her undergarments and medicine in her work bag with the false bottom. Already, people throughout the Jewish quarter whispered from ear to ear that Irena, whom most knew only by her secret code name, Yolanta, was the woman who could manage anything. Irena would work now even more feverishly, and she would not tell Jan Dobrachinsky what she was planning. Chapter 6. Ghetto Juggernaut. Warsaw, 1941-1942. Irena's boss, Irka Schultz, walked slowly away from the ghetto checkpoint. Relief flooded over her. It was always like this. Capricious, cruel things happened there at the gates, and she counted herself lucky any afternoon when she didn't witness something that made her heart ache afterward for hours. Somewhere in the distance, a gunshot rang out. A dog barked. A streetcar rattled. All the sounds of life in occupied Warsaw. But when she heard the sound of a manhole cover rattling underfoot, Irka jumped. It wasn't that the sound was unfamiliar. She just knew heartache that afternoon was coming after all. The noise came again, the tinny sound of quiet scraping and a small child sniffling disconsolately. Looking quickly around her, Irka fell to her knees. She peeled off her gloves to get a better grip and lifted up the cover. The dirty ice from the street spread patches of damp on her skirt. Irka knew that there was only one reason anyone would be crawling along the city sewers. Jewish street children, and ghetto smugglers made their treacherous commute to the Aryan side in search of food through these underground canals. Irka peered inside. The stench made her eyes water, and she turned away for a moment. When she looked back, a small child's face, etched with fear and hunger, peered back up at her. The little girl had tightly combed blonde hair and big blue eyes, but she was more than half-starved and now completely filthy. The child was too frail to climb out of the hole alone, and struggled. Irka tugged her up gently and hissed quietly into the sewer to see if anyone else would follow.
Vitai! Chi jest tuktosz? Hello, is anyone there?
But the girl was alone. Perhaps she had been left behind for moving too slowly. Irina's heart caught when she saw a scrap of paper pinned to the girl's dress with a thin sewing needle. On it, in a shaky hand, was written a single digit, the child's age, a telegraphic mother's plea for someone, some stranger, to help her daughter. That detail would stay with Irka always. Irka could see that the girl was weak, but she would have to walk at least a little bit of the way. Anti-Semitic hooligans and petty blackmailers prowled the area near the ghetto, looking for anyone who looked desperate or famished enough to be Jewish. Jews on the Aryan side were hopelessly vulnerable to extortion. Stay calm, Irka urged herself. Walk slowly. Fear was the biggest tell of all. Parents who sent their children out of the ghetto reminded them urgently to wear the best disguise of all, happy faces. She smiled a bright, fake smile at the little girl and drew her fingers up along her cheeks in a silent gesture. Then she put a finger to her lips. Quiet. The child's eyes grew wider. As they moved toward the shadows of a side street, Irka hurriedly considered. The girl needed a doctor. Irina could feel how hot and thin the girl's hand was, and she tried not to hold it too tightly. Catastrophic. The word floated to mind and hung there stubbornly. That meant the orphanage on Novogrodska Street was the only option. There were physicians on staff. Irina Sendler had put a system in place already for this kind of situation. It wasn't the first time they had done this. They discovered wasted Jewish foundlings on the wrong side of the wall with depressing regularity, and there was a code. She would clean the little girl up as best she could and get word to Irina. Then Irka would pick up the telephone and ring the Father Bauduin children's home. This time, perhaps, she would ask her friend Vladislava, "Can I stop by today to drop off that coat I borrowed?" Today meant it was an emergency. By the time Jan Dobraczynski returned the children to the ghetto, the office conspirators were almost certainly already placing Jewish children living wild on the Aryan side of the city with local Polish foster families and in citywide care institutions as the opportunity and the illegal paperwork presented itself. Sometime early in the winter of 1941-42, they started taking even more daring and organized action. This was what Irina had been planning. Conditions in the ghetto were deteriorating precipitously that winter. Everyone that year agreed that few winters in recent memory had ever been so cold or unforgiving. And that meant that, by the time the early spring arrived in Warsaw in 1942, Irina Sendler was no longer occasionally helping Jewish families. She and her cell were systematically helping Jews locate the paperwork that they needed to disappear into the city. In the autumn of 1941, a lucky break had shown them a new way to do it. The women had made contact with a local priest in the distant city of Lvov, whose parish church had burned along with all its records. The priest offered to give them his remaining cache of blank birth certificates, which now could not be cross-checked by German authorities. Irka had made the dangerous journey to fetch them and carried them back on the train, tucked in an old valise she tried to carry lightly. If the women could find a regular supply of blank documents, they had a solution. Lvov was about to have a birth rate explosion. That winter, the women used a few of the precious blank certificates from Lvov to save an old friend and his family. Dr. Witwicki and his family were still in hiding, and new Polish documents would take him out of constant danger. Irene was still smuggling into the ghetto the professor's handmade dolls for the children, sculpted in a quiet room on Jozova Street in the old town. Irene had carried a new stash of dolls to Dr. Korczak's ghetto orphanage, especially for the littlest of Jan Dobraczynski's street children. She still fretted about those 32 youngsters, and by now she knew all their names and faces. Irene also badgered her friends in the ghetto, Adam, Eva, Rachela, Yusef, Alla, to flee and go into hiding on the Aryan side. Death stalked the ghetto. She would find them papers. She would find safe houses. She implored them all now. When they shook their heads sadly, Irene couldn't hide her frustration and worry. "It's too risky to hide a Jew, Irene," Eva told her over and over. Life was not so different now. Not really, Eva insisted. It was just the same work as on the Aryan side, where there were also hungry, homeless youngsters. "The children all just need a little heart and a lot of bread," said Eva. Irene doggedly tried to wear her down, to convince her. But Eva would not risk the lives of her friends. Finally, Eva was firm with her friend. "Please don't ask me," she pleaded with Irene, squeezing her friend's hand kindly. "I won't stay with you. I can't endanger you like that." With Adam, the conversations were even more maddening. Adam was angry and impassioned. All around him were death and suffering. Crazed SS men used pedestrians for target practice. Bodies lined the ghetto streets like useless litter each morning. Men wept in the streets, begging. All this, and the Poles hated Jews nearly as much as the Germans. Irene wanted him to hide among them? She tried to reason with him, but everything just came out sounding defensive, and Adam retreated from her touch. Could their love survive this? The thought nagged at her. It would break her heart to lose Adam. He drew back into himself and his beloved books. He retreated to the past, trying to find answers somewhere in the dry histories of ancient empires for the nightmare present. When she tried to embrace him, tried to touch his arm or smooth his shirt collar, he turned away brusquely. And there was a small part of her that wondered, too. Was it only the ghetto standing between them? Or did he think in those moments of his Jewish wife and his mother's sense of his failure? Would the fact that he was Jewish and she was Aryan divide them from each other, as the occupiers had always intended? Guilt and shame stalked every conscience inside these hellish walls. Children whimpered on the streets for a crumb of bread in front of the shops, and there was no choice if one had bread in one's pocket but to avert one's eyes in horror and walk on. Survival depended on it. But one knew shame in that moment. Besides, Adam said, he could not leave the youth center. Irene knew it was his trump card, his way of ending their argument. There was nothing she could say. Adam's circle cared for the sickest and littlest of the ghetto orphans. And, like Alla's colleague Dr. Landau, the lecturer at Alla's clinic's secret medical classes, Adam also passionately believed he was fighting on a battlefield in a war against barbarity. His safety, Adam reminded Irene gently, didn't matter. She was risking her life daily for the street children. She was risking her life smuggling vaccines into the ghetto. If he asked her to stay at home to avoid the danger, would she? She knew she would not. So did Adam. So, instead, Irene and her friends on both sides of the wall threw themselves into a new and even more stunningly courageous mission. Irene would never again let a child be returned to the ghetto. They would find safe homes on the Aryan side for scores of Jewish children. In the spring of 1942, an estimated 4,000 children lived alone on the streets of the Aryan side, and 2,000 of them were Jewish. Some of the children on the Aryan side were homeless orphans trying to survive alone by begging and stealing. But desperate families were already sending well-loved but starving children across the wall. Children like the little girl whom Irka Schultz discovered that afternoon in a sewer manhole. Sometimes parents came with them, and for a time families tried to hide together. More often than not, the parents perished, shot in the roundups or at the camps later. Sometimes a quiet sense of duty tore apart families sooner. Some family members were easier to save than others. It was a fact of life in the Jewish quarter. Who could abandon one's aging parents? They could not make the dangerous passage across the walls. Children who could walk were sent out alone by stricken parents or guided out by smugglers into the hands of friends or strangers. Hundreds of children made that frightening passage through the sewers. In 1942, Wanda Zemska was 8 years old when she stepped into the murky waters. "Above the entrance to the sewer, I said goodbye to father who stayed behind," she remembered. The journey through the sewers was quite complicated. At times it looked like a dirty river. I can remember how hard it was for me to climb out of the sewer. I couldn't reach from one rung to another. When Irina heard of children in danger and hiding on the Aryan side, she now had daring solutions. Soon, Irina would go one step further. What would be the fate of the children who were already orphaned inside the ghetto? Toddlers could not flee on their own initiative. There were no parents left to send them. She saw these children every day at Adam's youth circle, and no matter how hard Adam worked to save them, he was failing. There was too much hunger and disease for small bodies. So Adam and Irina did the obvious. They started taking orphans out of the ghetto sometime that winter. With her epidemic control pass, it wasn't even illegal if the child were desperately ill. Youngsters with a tuberculosis death sentence could be transported by ambulance to one of the remaining Jewish sanatoriums in Otwock. Once again, she was walking in her father's footsteps. And sometimes a cough might not be tuberculosis, and a child would disappear into a friend's home in their old village. If she could not save Adam, together at least they could save a few of these children. If the false cases were discovered, the risks, of course, were colossal. Giving a Jewish child a piece of bread meant death, for both the giver and the receiver. Sending a child out of the ghetto to hide with a Polish family came at the price of a bullet to the head on a street corner. But the draconian consequences also meant, as Irina could not help but observe, that one might as well do more than just smuggle in vaccines. You could die only once, and she and Adam were united at least in action. In time there would be myriad routes in and out of the ghetto, and Irina would employ them all to smuggle out Jewish children. On the day Irka discovered the little girl in the Warsaw sewer, the women had already set up one of their first protocols in cooperation with the Father Bauduin Catholic Children's Home. It was a simple extension of their work in the social welfare offices, and Jaga Petrovska and Irka Schultz were the network's front women in this operation. There were two indispensable new partners by early 1942. The first was a warm and pretty young woman named Vladislava, Vladka, Marinovska. Friends marveled at how Vladka's upswept tumble of bright blonde hair gave her the air of a romantic heroine, and in every photograph of her she is smiling. Vladka was also that year the mother of a sturdy little boy, and she worked as a senior house mother and social worker at the Father Bauduin Children's Home for Polish Infants, Toddlers, and Homeless Mothers. Vladka's job was to vet prospective foster parents, and that meant that she knew better than anyone how to find caregivers who were willing to take in children for the customary boarding fee the city offered. Drawing Vladka into their conspiracy was an easy decision, born of necessity. One did not draw friends lightly into this network, especially not friends with small children, not if one could help it. And Vladka was an old friend already. But that winter the women were faced with a crisis. They had a Jewish child who needed a home, and there was a desperate shortage of false identity papers. In hushed and urgent tones, Irena and Irka considered. Irka fretted. She trusted Vladka. More than that, she trusted Irena's judgment. But the Gestapo was already watching the Father Bauduin children's home, and Irka worried that the risks were too great. But will the child be safe there, Irena? The question hung in the air. Irena lived with that question always. You can be calm about the child, came Irena's steady reply. Vladka Marinovska is there. Irka nodded and reached for her coat. She would go now and make the invitation. It was a short walk from the social welfare office on Svorta Street to the orphanage. Irka walked briskly. Her path to Novogrodska Street took her south only a few blocks. The ghetto checkpoint where Svorta and Tvarda Streets met had been sealed off with bricks and barbed wire in 1941, when the ghetto boundary was moved northward. The shifting wall was a constant presence. Like Irena and Yaga and Jadwiga, Irka was still in and out of the ghetto several times a day, and this toddler was one of hers. It was hard not to feel protective. The orphanage was an imposing brick building, and she was still planning on what she would say as she climbed the steps, but she was saved from further agonizing when Vladka greeted her with a friendly hello. Would Vladka take a walk with her? Vladka's eyes narrowed intelligently. Anything was better than trying to talk in a building where they all knew Gestapo spies were planted. Irka knew she could trust Vladka. Or she thought she could, but she still hesitated. The war placed all sorts of decent people in impossible positions. Vladka waited. Irka took a deep breath. There's a toddler, she faltered. There are several children. We need to place them in care. Vladka brightened. Of course, Irka, it is no problem. Just take them to the office and... Irka had taken a deep breath and now interrupted. Vladka, there are no papers. Then she waited. There. It was done. Only a fool could misunderstand the situation, and nothing about Vladka Marinovska was foolish. An undocumented child was almost certainly Jewish. Vladka considered. She kicked a bit of melting ice with her boot and then looked up to the sky. She saw the wisps of clouds. Perhaps she thought of her own little boy, Andrei. She had to think of his safety. The Gestapo was all around her. A spy could be a wet nurse or a desperate mother. Old friends could even be provocateurs in this crazy world of the occupation. The question was not whether she wished to help, but whether she could trust Irka. She turned and looked at her friend, and Irka looked back at her. Then Vladka took a deep breath. Yes, I will take the child. Irka Schultz took a deep breath also. Thank you. I didn't ask for any details, Vladka said later. She asked me to take those children and to find them a safe home in a foster family. I agreed to help without any questions. Turning toward the orphanage, Vladka tilted her head. I should get back. Come another time and we can discuss how we make placements. When Irka returned, she brought with her another contact, a woman whom she explained might sometimes bring the children to Vladka. The new contact was a 26-year-old woman, and her name, Irka said, was Sonia. But Sonia was the code name of a Polish nurse named Helena Szeszko, one of the newest additions to Irena Sendler's growing network. Ala Golomb Grinberg was the one who had drawn Helena into their conspiracy. Helena Szeszko was a senior operative in a resistance cell in the medical underground. Ala was the chief nurse in the ghetto. They had worked together hand in glove for months already. Across the city there were dozens of small cells, each working in secrecy and isolation. Slowly those circles were finding points of connection. The need for medical underground was urgent. After all, neither sick Jews in hiding on the Aryan side nor wounded resistance operatives caught in the ghetto could check themselves into local hospitals, and everywhere in the Jewish quarter, the need for supplies was desperate. Another old friend was at the heart of this sister network. One of its leaders was Dr. Julius Majkowski in the infectious disease offices. Some of his epidemic control passes had gone to Irena, Irka, Yaga, and Jadwiga, but one of them had gone to Helena. That meant that Helena, too, could come and go from the ghetto, and she could take sick Jewish children and hidden supplies with her in the municipal ambulances. Vladka knew nothing of this. She knew nothing of this until years after. Knowing was dangerous. It was enough to know that Irka had to take the Jewish children out of the ghetto and put them in a safe place, she said. And it was enough to know that Sonia, and sometimes also Alla Golam Grimberg, would appear at her door at a moment's notice. Alla's husband, Arek, was still in and out of the ghetto, working with the Jewish resistance, and his underground contacts, along with Alla's senior position at the Judenrat, meant that Alla, too, could slip in and out of the ghetto any time she needed. Sometimes, Alla's daughter remembers today, her mother took the little girl with her on these trips into that other world. My mother took me out, she says. I don't remember how. I was out a couple of times, coming and going. But mostly Alla went alone. At the orphanage, the women established a code. There was a telephone at the Father Bauduin children's home, and when someone rang Vladka, the conversations were nothing but frivolous girl talk. They chatted idly about borrowing skirts or scarves. They would make plans to come for tea or check in on ailing mothers. There would be a day and a time, and there would always be something about color. Color and clothing was how the right child could be identified, now and later. Vladka kept a careful log of the clothes and the children's appearances, especially the ones who came to her without papers. How else, after the war, would their parents find them? Vladka's simple notations would very quickly inspire in Irena something bold and amazing. Vladka's modest accounting of the waifs and orphans who passed through her care was almost certainly the reason Irena herself now kept a master list of all the children. Healthy children who were fair-haired and blue-eyed, or those who didn't look stereotypically Jewish, could be integrated into the life of the orphanage once the appropriate false documents were located and an official registry number could be given. False documents were one of Helena Sheshka's specialties. Helena and her husband, Leon, got their start in the underground setting up a cell to forge identity papers. Polish-looking children weren't the ones who gave Irena Sendler the nightmares that were already starting to plague her sleep by 1942. Once these children were safely on the Aryan side, saving them was not yet so uncertain. Getting out took courage, and sometimes the children were consummate actors. Alla came from a famous theatrical family. Now she coached children at playing sick in order to save them. More often, though, on their perilous ambulance rides with hidden children, Alla and Helena counted on the German fear of infection and hid the youngster under piles of dirty rags or inside already occupied coffins. That was bad enough, but not what gave Irena night terrors. What jolted her awake at night were dreams about the children with, quote, bad Semitic features. Irena's fears were not unfounded. These children couldn't be seen even for an instant on the Aryan side and arrived at the orphanage in burlap sacks slung over a workman's shoulders, delivered to the back door as laundry or potatoes. For these arrivals, Vladka had to be sure a foster family was ready to take the children instantly and keep them constantly quiet and hidden. These youngsters were rarely at the Father Bauduin children's home for more than a few hours. Sometimes they came with Helena, sometimes with Irka or Alla, and sometimes, as the number of children grew in the spring of 1942, with Yaga Piotrowska and Jadwiga Denika. When these children could not be placed instantly, the women had no choice but to take desperate chances and keep them in their own homes until there were arrangements. Irena, Yaga, Jadwiga and Vladka all hid children in their apartments sometimes. At Vladka's, her elementary school-age son, Andrei, had the grave responsibility of helping his mother care for desperately ill younger children. Today, Andrei is a distinguished elderly gentleman with a warm smile and gracious manner, still living in Warsaw. He remembers those days with his mother and how his job as a small boy was taking the young Jewish hideouts to the bathroom down the hall, where someone had to watch them carefully at the toilet. Little bodies coming back from the brink of starvation, he says, with the grim expression of someone who remembers, could suffer from appalling gastric troubles. The children came and went from the Father Baudouin Children's Home, and with every passing day the Gestapo grew more suspicious. German agents combed Vladka's official records, searching for any scrap of evidence. But the real records were never in the file cabinets. Vladka would never be so foolish. When the paperwork frustrated them, the Gestapo thugs in their midst held guns to Vladka's head in the corridor and bullied all the staff with threats of mass executions. By the spring of 1942, their network grew, and so did the surveillance. The children who came and went officially were carefully monitored and their paperwork scrutinized by the occupiers. But it only meant, Irena stubbornly concluded, that more of the children would have to come and go, at ever greater risk, completely off the record. Although the Gestapo didn't know it yet, it was Irena's network they were hunting. Irena was the tactical commander of this growing citizens' army, which now included nearly 24 people, drawn together from the political underground, the welfare offices, and the Jewish community. The risks with that number of people were enormous, and no one was in more danger than Irena. When Irena's colleague, Irka Schultz, discovered the little girl in the sewer, it should have all been easy. But the entire operation nearly crumbled because of another risk they had not weighed carefully enough. The child had, quote, good looks. Irka passed the emergency code along to Irena and then to Vladka. The child needed medical attention quickly, and the orphanage had staff doctors. Because the fair-haired toddler looked so quintessentially Polish, Irena and Irka decided to risk going through legitimate channels at the Father Baudouin Children's Home. The women quickly agreed on a plan and a story. Irka would take the child to the orphanage and hand her over to the clerk at reception. There would have to be a formal report to the German police, notifying them of a foundling. And Irka would write in her careful hand how she, a social worker, in nothing more than the course of her duties, had chanced upon the little girl in a stairwell somewhere far from the Jewish quarter. When an investigation turned up nothing, the child would be allowed to stay at the orphanage. After all, the world was full of war orphans. The plan, however, went terribly wrong from the first moment. In the orphanage clinic, a brusque nurse took the little girl away and firmly pointed Irka to a hard chair set far back from the doorway. "Wait here, Pani." Irka sat. Paperwork, she supposed. With the Germans, there was always more paperwork. What Irka could not know was that, behind closed doors, her life hung in the balance. The duty physician had taken one good look at this famished child, and she was already on the phone with the police, demanding they take action. The doctor never guessed the child was Jewish. She guessed instead that Irka was a child abuser and the little girl's unwed mother. When a Polish policeman arrived to escort her to the station around the corner, Irka was dumbstruck and left reeling. "How do you prove you are not a child's mother?" Irka tried asking the policeman. She desperately needed to know the answer. Irka insisted all afternoon that the child was not her own. She explained that she had found her. No one there, the police informed her tartly, believed that story. Irka was flummoxed, and soon she started to be frightened. She could hardly tell the truth. It would be a certain death sentence for her and the toddler. Helping a Jewish child meant execution. and it was obvious to anyone where a child climbing out of a sewer had come from. They went around and around in circles. At last, the officer snapped shut his folder and stood up, smoothing out his jacket. "There will be a thorough investigation, Pani Schultz," the bored officer warned her. "Until then..."